right. Our final case for argument this morning is Ryan Lawrence Anthony versus Garrett Laney.
May it please the court, Kurt Hermanson on behalf of Ryan Anthony. I'd like to start. Yesterday I filed an erratum, and hopefully the court has that.
I haven't seen it.
So basically what I put in my reply brief is that David Jorling was walking by the murder scene the night of the murder. And when he talked to the police in 1980 on Tuesday, so the murder was most probably on Saturday, July 26th. He talked to the police on Tuesday when they met him at the library. He was studying for the bar. And he was a critical witness because he had a good enough description of someone who was in the Volks' home that they were able to do a sketch, and his testimony made it more likely that it was serial killer Smith who committed the murders rather than Ryan Anthony. But then after filing the erratum yesterday, I reread the rebuttal closing argument of the district attorney and understood why there's some confusion about when Jorling saw someone in the Volks' home.
He argued both in his throughout that Jorling was mistaken and it was actually the night of the murder, which seems to me to favor you, actually.
Correct.
So I don't really know why you've been fighting that construction of it all along.
Standing here today, I think the most likely thing is, and I wasn't the trial attorney, standing here today, I think the most likely thing is, yes, the murder occurred at 10:30 on Saturday and Mr. Jorling was walking by then. Because the Volkses, went to church on Sundays and they didn't go to church that Sunday. So standing here today, I believe that the district attorney's rebuttal closing argument, the last thing the jurors heard was what happened. That we have an eyewitness who is now,
He said in his opening closing argument too, that's been their position all along. Anyway, and it makes sense. So
in 2007...
But I think you better get to the substance of the argument. I mean, you have a little more support than you thought you did. But
yes, Your Honor. And in 2007, Jorling, you know, by then, he doesn't remember. He's a city attorney and was a DA, but he's a very credible witness. So I think...
Counsel, let me ask you this, because your arguments in the briefing as well sounds in de novo review, but isn't our standard highly deferential under these circumstances? And the state court did make certain findings. Can you focus on those findings and tell me why they're an unreasonable application of the facts or law in this case? So the state court said that the declarant was singularly untrustworthy. He later disavowed his alleged inculpatory statements. He made disjointed and evasive statements. And that the corroboration is inadequate. So focusing on the facts, explain to me why they're an unreasonable determination.
So first, we don't concede that 2254D applies. We did analyze 2254D, but just as a threshold matter, if the state court didn't identify the right legal standard, then we might not even be in deferential territory. So if we look at the last reasoned opinion in this case, and that's State v. Anthony, there's no mention of Chambers whatsoever.
Let's assume that we're in deferential review land, okay, and proceed from there.
So I think we win under all three parts of 2254D. So there's the contrary to clause, the unreasonable application clause, and a unreasonable determination of the facts. So under all three, I think we win because the state court's analysis is not the Chambers analysis. What the state court did is they looked to Casares-Mendez, and Casares-Mendez says very narrowly, what you focus on in Oregon under the Oregon Evidence Code is the trustworthiness of the declarant. And what that did, what that analysis did, is it just condensed everything down into, is Mr. Smith, serial killer Smith, trustworthy? And that is completely the wrong analysis. The analysis under Chambers is, how do we see if there are assurances of reliability? And Chambers looked at three things for assurances of reliability. Chambers didn't limit its analysis to, let's just look at whether the declarant is reliable. That, respectfully, that's a ridiculous analysis, because he's a serial killer. He's not a trustworthy person. So what we look at is when he made these statements, not in 2006, not in 2007, when he confessed to being part of killing that poor couple in Oswego, Oregon, was it a statement against penal interest? And it absolutely was, because unlike the state court's analysis, he wasn't a convicted serial killer. He made that confession before he was ever convicted.
To another serial killer,
to Mr. Jackson.
Just to back up for a moment, could you just tell us what you think is the rule that Chambers clearly establishes?
Yes, Your Honor. So in Chambers, we want to see assurances of reliability, and the way we determine that is three ways. First,
as to whether a hearsay barrier to a admission of evidence about a third party is a constitutional due process violation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that right?
It's the right to present a complete defense, and I would even narrow Chambers to cases in which there's a confession or at least statements against penal interest. So here, when we look at Chambers, Chambers has three things. First, were the statements made spontaneously to a close acquaintance shortly after the murder? Check. Second, are they corroborated by some other evidence? Check. Third, were they self-incriminatory? That is, were they against penal interest? All three of those things apply in this case. So first of all,
isn't the most one thing that struck me is that you don't really make anything out of this, but the most corroborative evidence with regard to Smith is that he was a serial killer in this precise area at this precise time of random people, and he was in Lake Oswego at least occasionally.
That's correct.
That sort of all gets lost in the shuffle, but the fact is this is not just somebody on the street that made this statement. It's somebody who actually was going around killing older people in their homes at this particular time in an area that included Lake Oswego.
That's absolutely right. He is a serial killer in the area who's arrested August 22nd of 1980. He's committing murders in and around Oswego, Oregon.
The analysis in the state case just ignores all of that. I mean, the fact is that this is a person as to whom there was, at least a good some reason to think that he could have done this because he did things just like it at just this time in this general area.
And that's why the state court, that's right, Your Honor, and that's why the state court analysis is both contrary to and an unreasonable application of Chambers. So even assuming that they carefully looked at Casares-Mendez, which does talk about Chambers, the last reasoned opinion in this case doesn't mention Chambers, but totally ignores the whole Chambers analysis. Instead, it myopically focuses only on whether Smith is a reliable witness.
Well,
not in 1980.
So in Chambers, I mean, the Chambers court said you can't mechanically apply a hearsay rule, right, to defeat justice. And one of the things they emphasized there was that the statements involved in this case were made and offered at trial under circumstances that provided considerable assurance of their reliability. So why wouldn't it be reasonable for a state court to look at that and say, well, that suggests that we should make some assessment of the reliability of these statements. And if we think they're not reliable, Chambers doesn't require us to admit them. Why is that an unreasonable reading of the case?
They should look at reliability, but the fundamental flaw in the state court's analysis is they're looking at reliability in 2006, 2007, not in 1980 when the statements are made. And that's when they're against penal interest. Smith, like all the, like as in Chambers, like as in Holmes, in all of these Supreme Court cases and Ninth Circuit cases, there's a recantation later, just like in Chambers. So we don't look at close in time to the trial because they would all fail. Under the state court's analysis, they would all fail because they all recanted. The proper analysis is under Chambers is to look at the time that the statements were made against penal interest.
So let me go back to my original question, because it I don't think is an accurate summation of the record to say that they focused only on the declarant's testimony. They did talk a lot about the untrustworthiness of his statement, the fact that he subsequently recanted, but they also said the statements were very disjointed, they were far from detailed, and it also talked about the opinion, the state court's opinion also talked about the weakness of the corroboration. So they're assessing essentially the reliability of the evidence that he wants to introduce. So tell me why, under deferential review, that's a misapplication of the facts.
Because again, when they're talking about it being evasive, his statements being evasive, they're not talking about 1980. They are not talking about his 1980 statements against penal interest. They're talking about, and they're quoting the appellate brief and saying even his appellate attorney says that Smith was evasive. And the reason they say that he was evasive is they were arguing that he was unavailable because he was refusing to answer questions and was being evasive and saying, oh, I don't know how many people I killed. That's the evasive part in 2006.
Yeah, his supposed confession to Jackson, me and another person did that one, was far from detailed and was itself contradicted by his subsequent denials to, among others, Jackson. Further, as we noted in our first opinion, nothing in the circumstantial evidence that defendant cites bolster the theory that Smith was the perpetrator.
Right. So they're looking at a recantation and saying, okay, so his first statements about being involved in the Oswego murders are unreliable because he recanted. And we know from...
But what is true, I think that the weakest part of his confessions is that they were very vague. I mean, in the other cases, they're often the confession says something that the public wouldn't know, and he said like a sentence. He certainly didn't say anything that makes his confession, it's at the time he made it.
It's true that his confessions are not as detailed as
They're not detailed at all. I mean, all he said was, you know, I killed the people or not even killed them. I did the crime in like Oswego with those people, something like that.
And we're talking about the right to present a defense. And
right.
Here...
I understand that. And
so,
I think
yeah, that, I don't...
But that's the...
It's a far
where your case and the...
But I think what makes...
The worst.
I'm sorry.
That's the situation as to which your case and the Chambers line of cases fit the worst. That is the detail... But maybe it's made up for by the fact that this guy was a serial killer in the area at the time doing similar crimes.
That's and that makes this case a lot stronger than Chambers and the other cases, is we know for a fact that he is a serial killer in that area at the time. And Jackson did say that Smith told him that he got money from those people in Lake Oswego, which puts him there. And if I may reserve the rest of my time.
All right.
May it please the court, Patrick Ebbett for the state of Oregon. Like petitioner, I'll begin with the Chambers issue. And first, as the court has noted, this is an AEDPA case. So the question is whether the Oregon Court of Appeals analysis was objectively unreasonable. That is, whether its conclusion that Smith's statements were insufficiently reliable under the due process factors as outlined in Chambers was so unreasonable that no fair-minded jurist could disagree. petitioner has not met his burden to show that in this case. And I'll begin.
What is the ER page on which the relevant discussion occurs?
I'm sorry?
What is the ER page on which the relevant state court discussion occurs?
I don't have the ER at my fingertips. I do have the Court of Appeals decisions. In fact,
all right. Are we talking about the...
State v. Anthony, 247 ORAP, 582 at 585 and 586. That is the 2012 decision. The 2012 decision refers back to the 2010 decision, which also makes... Oh, excuse me, it's ER 149. Thank you, counsel. And ER 149 and follow. So that's generally where they are. But those two opinions both contain the Oregon Court of Appeals analysis. The Court of Appeals in its 2012 opinion refers to its 2010 analysis, so you need to look at them together. With that, I do want to touch on this matter of Mr. Jorling. Petitioner's argument at the pretrial proceeding on his motion to allow Smith's hearsay statements was that they were corroborated because Jorling saw motorcycles the day after the evening after the murder and saw this person, glanced at this person backlit at the doorway of the Volk's home the evening after their murders. And the defense theory was that the murderer had returned the day after the murder. That was the defense theory at the pretrial proceeding. They were not arguing that somehow Mr. Jorling was mistaken. They were simply saying that he was seeing the murderer return to the scene 24 hours later. That was the theory not only at pretrial, but also at trial in front before the jury. That was the defense theory. So now we're hearing for the first time a new defense theory, that Jorling was mistaken.
That was the government's theory. That was the government's theory at trial.
The government's theory was that Mr. Anthony was the killer. It wasn't.
But that this witness was had the wrong day.
Yes, that was on rebuttal. That was
on rebuttal. I think it was also said in the opening.
Excuse me.
I think it was also said on the opening argument. I'm not sure.
It may have been. The record is voluminous, and
that was the government's theory all the way
right,
through.
Right, right. But that was not petitioner's theory. Okay, so what we're looking at, what the Court of Appeals was facing when it was a petitioner's theory that this was a return of the killer scenario that the petitioner was advocating. That's the record that the Court of Appeals was looking at. But even assuming, let's assume for the sake that theory is correct.
Let me go back to the point I was making before. In this paragraph in the government, in the Oregon Court of Appeals 2012 decision, the one thing that's never mentioned is that this person, as to circumstantial evidence, is that the person who confessed was a serial killer in the area at the time, preying on older people in their homes and at least one occasion with a knife. I mean, that is certainly relevant circumstantial evidence as to the reliability. If you just had some person on the street saying this and acting the way this person did, that would be one thing. But in fact, you have somebody who you had at least some reason to think was committing crimes of this kind at that time in this place and so on.
Mr. Smith was a killer. As was Mr. Jackson, and they murdered people in the greater Portland area with a population of 2.2 million people.
And Mr. Smith was in Las. That was also established that he had family in Lake Oswego, and he went there occasionally. And I don't remember if any of his crimes were committed there. They were committed at least nearby. So all of that is some.
Mr. Smith committed murders in Washington, in southern Washington. He committed murders in the Portland area. Yes, he was a bad dude. That's undisputed. But what we have, we know one thing, that bad people like that do.
And he committed murders going into the homes of elderly people as well.
I don't recall the victims necessarily being some sort of profile that they were elderly people.
They were elderly people.
Some of them may have been elderly people,
and some of them were in their own homes.
Yes, he was in home invasion robbers, no question about that. The fact remains that his confession to Smith was to Jackson was highly vague. It was Jackson himself described it as boasting. We know that people in this.
The question here is whether Anthony could put it as a defense.
Excuse me?
It is the scope of Anthony's due process rights to put on a defense, right?
Right.
That's the question here. And the fact is that there was, I mean, Anthony's alibi was pretty weird. But he was fervent about it, and he had at least, I mean, he had somebody confessing, even if briefly, to somebody he knew right after the crime against his penal interest before he'd been charged with anything. And there was a fair amount of corroboratory evidence, not enough to think that we're not trying to reach a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt or even a preponderance of the evidence, right? We're just trying to reach a standard that this is reliable enough that the jury should be able to consider it, essentially.
I think the standard as articulated by this court in Gable and other cases is persuasive assurances of trustworthiness is how this court has characterized the Chambers standard. And what we don't have here are those persuasive assurances of trustworthiness. What we have is a bragging serial killer. We examine these corroborating circumstances a little bit. They really, the Oregon Court of Appeals determination that these corroborating circumstances were, quote, a far cry from the kind of corroborating circumstances we see in Chambers and cases applying Chambers was certainly not objectively unreasonable. There was, even assuming Jorling was mistaken as to the date and that he actually walked by the night of the murder, we have motorcycles. And the fact that Smith rode a Honda motorcycle and apparently one of these motorcycles may have been a Honda motorcycle, that is hardly a mark of Zorro. That's hardly unique. It's summertime on the West Coast. Motorcycles are common. They were parked, and that doesn't establish much of anything. He took a glance, in his words, at the doorway and saw a backlit figure. The record does not demonstrate that this person looked more or less like Smith or more or less like petitioner. There was some dispute about that at the pretrial hearing, but there was no, one observer said, I think it looks more like Smith. Other one said, I think it looks more like petitioner. There's nothing persuasive about that.
Why isn't that a question for the jury?
Excuse me?
Why isn't that a question for the jury? That's one of the things that I think Gable keeps saying, that ultimately, if there's a dispute about things, it's for the jury. So,
The rule against hearsay is grounded in the notion that statements under oath are more trustworthy than statements out of court. That is a time-honored rule, and what Chamber stands for, it says in certain narrow circumstances, when those out-of-court statements bear incredible indicia of trustworthiness, we will admit them. It doesn't simply say, it doesn't do what Chambers takes pains to explain. It's not just saying, point blank, the hearsay rule doesn't apply to criminal defendants.
If
it's not saying that.
If this evidence were put on, the government obviously could put Smith on to deny it, right?
Excuse me?
If this evidence had been put on, the government could have put Smith on to deny it, to deny that he said it, to deny that he did it.
Correct.
Right? So it's not like this was going to come in without refutation.
Excuse me?
It's not that it was going to come in without refutation or without somebody under oath. I mean, Smith can come in and say under oath whatever the government wants him, whatever he agrees to say under oath.
I mean, that would simply do away with the trustworthiness. It would just simply say, okay, since the person's available, which is kind of in conflict with federal rules of evidence that say that hearsay evidence of this type should only come in if the witness is unavailable. But be that as it may, simply because the witness is available doesn't mean it all comes in. That's not what Chambers stands for. Chambers says there has to be persuasive assurances of trustworthiness, real corroboration. In Chambers, McDonald made multiple confessions to close friends shortly after the crime. One witness testified that they saw McDonald commit the shooting. We don't have anything like that here, not even anything close to anything like that here. And nor do we have anything like this court's most recent case analyzing Chambers, Gable. Not only was Gable not an AEDPA case, but Gable, there were really, there was a very detailed confession that included facts that only the killer would know. We don't have anything like that here. Nothing even close. In fact, and I think this is, when I was looking at Gable, one thing I noted in Gable was that Gable himself made statements implicating his guilt. He said he did it to a number of different people, including his wife. Yet this court found that he met the Shuck gateway for actual innocence and noted that, these were just boasts. It's not uncommon for people, particularly in this milieu, to make idle boasts. That doesn't mean these boasts are true or they bear any kind of assurances of trustworthiness, and that is not the circumstance here.
Before you run out of time, counsel, can you briefly address the question of prejudice? Let's assume, for the sake of argument, a Chambers error. In particular, what were the statements about the pillowcase, the DNA evidence found on the pillowcase?
Right. The this bluntly, this case is not a whodunit.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
Excuse me?
I didn't hear the last thing you said. This case is not something.
This case is not a whodunit. The petitioner was, and this was sort of the compelling reason why the state finally charged this case, the DNA technology finally developed to a point where they could analyze this improper.
Yes, about 8 years before they actually did the DNA.
Right.
The pillowcase, when it was found, was in the drawer? Was it a closed drawer?
It was in a bureau. I don't recall whether the bureau was closed or not. I believe it was. Or at least partially closed. But that was incredibly compelling evidence because not only did petitioner acknowledge that he was at the scene shortly after the murder, that he had dragged the bodies around, but the evidence that his blood was at the scene, not only on the towel, but in the pillowcase, in a bureau, suggested that
he had a specific explanation for why his DNA would be on the pillowcase, did he not?
Excuse me?
He had a specific explanation.
He tended to chew his nails, and perhaps that was why his blood was on the pillowcase. But that was hardly plausible. Rational explanation was that he had, after the murder, he had gone searching for the victim's money and had rifled through the bureau with his bloody hand, and that's how the blood ended up on the pillowcase.
He acknowledges he was there, and he acknowledged that he touched, and he acknowledged way back that he had touched. He had specifically, I think, identified the towel and the pillowcase.
He did not acknowledge that he touched the pillowcase initially.
You mean before they
did? No, he only acknowledged that he did not, in his statements to the detectives, he did not mention anything about
the initial statement volunteering that he was at the scene said he'd wiped his hands on the
with
towel.
With a towel. But
there was no mention of the
pillowcase. Mention of the pillowcase, no mention of being in the bureau. This was all something that.
Right, but the one thing it seems to be agreed upon now, but I'm not sure why, that the DNA had to be his blood and couldn't just be his touching things.
Right. No, there was no dispute.
Why is that? I'm just curious about why.
I think it was given the volume. I mean, there were blood drops on the pillowcase. I don't think this was the kind of thing where the petitioner was in a position to argue that the DNA on the pillowcase was not from his blood. I don't think that was something that he even attempted to argue.
I think they said that at some earlier point, but by the time of the trial, they seemed to be agreeing that it was his blood, but I'm not sure why. Okay, maybe I will ask that to your opponent.
I see them out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
So just to jump right into prejudice, I don't think it applies. And if we look at Holmes versus South Carolina, there the Justice Alito, writing for the unanimous court, said that you can't have a rule where you exclude third-party culpability evidence just because the forensic evidence is overwhelming. And so Justice Alito, writing for the Supreme Court, reversed and said you have to let that in. And we don't concede that it was blood. If we do say blood in the briefing, my apologies. But if we there's no ABO. There's always been a dispute.
I know that, and by that they say is because you needed more. I don't know whether that was ever discussed at trial. I read a lot
there
of
were,
transfer,
yeah, trial, there were a number of discussions about, like, it could be sweat, it could be transfer touch. So the DNA evidence is not conclusive.
But you seem not only in the brief, but I think in the arguments at trial to concede that it was blood.
The argument was that it could be a bunch of different things and not blood. And there was cross-examination about...
Is it correct that in his initial statement he did not mention the pillowcase, and then subsequently when his DNA was discovered, then there was an explanation of as to why his DNA might have landed on the pillowcase?
I don't know that he was asked about the pillowcase, and I know that when he talked to the police, you know, he stopped talking to them, so there may not have been time.
I'll give you extra time. What is the explanation on why his DNA was on the pillowcase that's inside of a drawer or bureau?
I would have to re-review what his testimony was at trial. I'm not remembering right now. I can submit that to the court in a letter.
No, that's fine. I did review that portion of the record. Offhand, I can't remember
exactly I know
there was an explanation as to why he walked over and put it back in the bureau.
There is an explanation, and I don't want to get it wrong. I don't want to give the wrong answer.
That's fine, counsel.
So, Your Honors, there is corroboration. There is assurances of reliability. Lake Oswego is a small community. People noticed the motorcycles are a big deal. They noticed that it was suspicious. They're new motorcycles. They match the motorcycle that Smith was driving. So that makes it more likely that it was Smith and not Anthony. There were two motorcycles, two men, and Smith said that he committed the crime with Atherton.
And the guy didn't drive a motorcycle. That was also
No, but the yeah, the, Atherton had a car. We don't know about the other motorcycle. So, but it tends to show that Smith, the serial killer, committed the murders, not Anthony. Serial killer Smith told Jackson he got money from people in Lake Oswego. The modus operandi of Smith, as Judge Berzon, you know, is recognizing, separates this case from all the other cases and makes it stronger, makes it more reliable. In the other cases, we didn't have a known serial killer. It denied him his right to present a complete defense, to say, the jury doesn't get to know. We're going to usurp the jury's function and not let them know that the serial killer is committing crimes in that area.
How is Chambers supposed to operate? You have this language in Chambers and in Gable about has to be persuasive or reliable or what. And so that seems to build in some second-guessing of the jury. Because it has to be persuasive to who? Presumably to the
right. It can't be unrelated.
Does
you can't
have to be possibly persuasive to a jury, or what? What are we saying?
Here, there are assurances of reliability because of the location, the modus operandi. The confessions aren't just that, you know, they put him in Lake Oswego. It's not that it's just speculation.
There are assurances of reliability. I mean, there are indices of reliability. That's what I'm trying to find out. What are we trying to... How strong does this have to be? I mean, for my part, I don't see why it has to be all that strong because you think it's going to a jury, but the language and the opinions seems to be talking persuasive, reliable,
I think the reason is because it's a due process violation, and when we're talking about... It's funny that it's just due process because they talk about compulsory process, they talk about the Sixth Amendment, and they... Actually, the Supreme Court doesn't really decide, like, is it all of those things, the right to have people testify, the right to... But they call it the right to present a complete defense. And that was denied here because of...
Now, you could have called Smith. Right, we know what Smith would have said, and he could have cross-examined him with all the, with everything, with what he'd said earlier, and with his, and presumably with all his earlier crimes and exactly what they were and where they were and so on. Why wasn't that adequate?
I don't know why the trial attorney didn't do that. I mean, they needed with a jurors want a narrative, and they want to be able to connect the dots. And without Jackson's testimony about that. And Jackson believed the statement.
But they could have, I presume they could have cross-examined Smith by reading what he said to Jackson.
Well, he would have just denied, he could have just denied it.
He would have denied it.
Would have denied
and he would have been evasive just the way he was.
Right. All right.
And then could they have brought Jackson on to say he actually just said this to me at that point?
I'm sorry?
If that happened, could they then have brought Jackson on to prove that he did say it to Jackson?
There was a, I mean,
might have skipped a step here. I mean, would the case look different if they had tried to put it on through Smith and then brought Jackson in to say whatever he was going to say?
I think from the pretrial hearings, it was clear the judge wasn't going to allow any of it.
Don't think that would have been allowed either?
I don't think it would have been allowed based on the pretrial rulings.
All right, thank you. Our questions took you over time, but we appreciate you standing up at the lectern for an extra time and answering our questions. I really appreciate the arguments from both sides. The matter is submitted, and we are adjourned for the day.